So the nuptial feast, the wedding feast. I think weddings are something many of us probably enjoy when we move beyond the idea of bridezilla and we can find some joy in weddings. And I think the reason we love weddings so much is because they're this proclamation to the victory of love. And so we love being invited to weddings because we get to come alongside that celebration, the ceremony, the pictures, and of course, the food. I love wedding food. Any of you love wedding food? And we have a feast. We gather around this beautiful feast, and it's amazing how we're filled with joy and laughter. So much celebration that we get to celebrate with this bride and this groom, this beautiful gift of love that they are to each other. Now, over the past few weeks, we talked about the Eucharist being a life-giving fruit, where the fruit of Eden was eaten and brought upon death to Adam and Eve and all future humanity. That now there's this life-giving fruit that brings, again, eternal life. We talked about the Eucharist being like bread from heaven, this daily meal that we constantly go to receive nourishment and to sustain us in the life that we live, the daily journey we're upon. We talked of the Eucharist as a medicine, something that heals us, that we have an illness called sin, and we need to be treated, we need to receive medicine to be healed. And just last week, Pastor Rep talked about the Eucharist as a place of rest, of peace, of being made whole again. Today, we talk about it as a meal of joy. All the other ones talked about what this gift does for us. But today focuses on the response, how we live out, how we act in response to it. We should be filled with joy. The word itself, Eucharist, means thanksgiving. We give thanksgiving with great joy. And we do it because of all the benefits. But not because we're indebted to the benefits, but because it's what we do. For example, if someone gave you a gift, a great, beautiful gift, and you say, well, I'm really happy because I have to be, because I'm obligated. Is that joyful? Is it joyful? No, no. Sometimes we treat God that way. Okay, Pastor, I'll be joyful because I guess God did do this all. Okay. And we just go through the motions. True joy is this change of heart. That it's not so much about trying to pay God what he's given to us, but rather just a simple state of being, of celebration. Love works this way all the time. When your spouse shows you an act of love, do you say, well, I might as well show them something back so they don't feel left out? No! That would be foolishness! Maybe we do once in a while, but ultimately, no, we share love because that's what we want to give love, we want to give love, we want to give love, and we don't care if we get anything back. And that's how God feeds us and loves us in this great gift of the Eucharist. He pours out all these benefits and just calls us to this banquet of joy, to celebrate with him in joy. And he constantly talks about it as a feast, as this banquet. In the Old Testament, he constantly uses this image of marriage, that he wants to marry his people. He is the groom and they are the bride. The reading of Isaiah spoke about this as he talks about the Lord preparing himself to meet his bride, and she is preparing herself to be beautiful and radiant in his presence. And he loves his bride so much. He rejoices in his bride. He even calls her, I love this, my delight is in her. Isn't that a beautiful name? Guys, you can use that tonight. Go look at your spouse and say, my delight is in you. Isn't that beautiful? He loves us so much. And Israel, his bride, who he delights in, takes this great gift from God and turns to idols. Idols. It's interesting. It says that God is a jealous God. Why is God so jealous? Because when Israel turns to idolatry, when Israel seeks to find love in another place, it is no better than adultery. And they do it again and again. They are taking the love God gave to them and said, I'm going to try to find it elsewhere. And as you go through the Old Testament, every time it fails, what do they do? They try to find another place to find love that's not God. And very few times in the scriptures do the children of Israel ever go to God the Father to find love. They keep finding new lovers. But God, in the midst of that, never left his unfaithful bride. And instead of pushing her away, instead of rejecting her, instead of saying, I've forgiven you too much already, I want nothing to do with you, instead of that, he pulls her in and says, you are mine, and I love you. I love you. Think of what the children Israel did. You heard it in the gospel reading. The king sends out his servants to welcome them into the wedding banquet. And what do? Well, they're too busy with their farming, with their business. And some of them even take and do shameful things, it says, to the servants, and even kill the servants. Welcome to the life of the prophets, those who try to speak of this love to God's people. But he never forgets them. He brings them close in an embrace and continues to desire to marry even us, his children. Do you remember your own engagement? I remember mine. I got down on a knee. We were on a bridge over this group of water. There was a beautiful gazebo. Flowers were blooming. And I looked at my beautiful Rachel in the eyes and said, will you marry me? Will you marry me? And she looked at me and she said, are you serious? I think sometimes we respond to God that way. Are you serious? You know what I've done. You know who I am. Are you serious? And he says, yes. Yes. Soren Kierkegaard wrote this beautiful piece. It's called The King and the Maiden. And I want you to hear it. This is an allegory about a king. Suppose there was a king who loved a humble maiden. The king was like no other king. Every statesman trembled before his power. No one dared breathe a word against him, for he had the strength to crush all opponents. And yet this mighty king was melted by love for a humble maiden who lived in a poor village in his kingdom. How would he declare his love for her? In an odd sort of way, his kingliness tied his hands. If he brought her to the palace and crowned her head with jewels and clothed her body in royal robes, she would surely not resist. No one dared resist him. But would she love him? She would say she loved him, of course, but would she truly? Or would she live happy with him in fear, nursing a private grief for the life she had left behind? Would she be happy at his side? How could he ever know for sure? If he rode to her forest cottage in his royal carriage with an armed escort waving bright banners, that too would overwhelm her. He did not want a cringing subject. He wanted a lover, an equal. He wanted her to forget that he was a king and she a humble maiden, and to let shared love cross the gulf between them. For it is only in love that the unequal can be made equal. The king, convinced he could not elevate the maiden without crushing her freedom, resolved to descend to her. So, clothed as a beggar, he approached her cottage with a worn cloak fluttering loose about him. This was not just a disguise. The king took on a totally new identity. He had renounced his throne to declare his love and to win hers. Is that not what God does? He didn't just put on a disguise. He didn't just play man. He was man. He became man for us. in such a simple display, not with angel armies and trumpets, not with his mighty hand, with all things are under his feet. No, he takes on flesh, the form of a baby even, and says, I love you. He takes on flesh to unite us to him. And this flesh he takes on, he then gives to us, his bride, the church. Ephesians 5 talks about husbands and wives and how they relate to each other. But at the end, Paul says, but I'm not talking about marriage. I'm talking about Christ and the church. That this marriage is an icon, an image pointing to the love I have for you, my children. God sends Jesus because he wants to marry us. He wants to pour out his love into us. And he doesn't get to pour it out in some pleasure. He pours out his love in agony. Like a grain of wheat that must be crushed and fall to the ground before it can sprout a stalk. Or a grape that must be crushed before it can become for us wine. He fully embraces humanity in agony and suffering and death. He fully takes on humanity so he can pour himself out into us, so that we can share in his divinity. That the very flesh and blood he offers us becomes this gift of Eucharist, becomes the wedding feast, the banquet which knows no end. And this is a meal that we celebrate now, but also is a foretaste of the feast to come, where the food and the wine will not stop flowing, for all to find joy and celebration. And he invites us into that through our baptisms and then constantly through this meal, an invitation where he says, come, come to me. And he comes to us today in a simple way, in bread and wine. And you're going to hear words that Jesus spoke in an upper room over 2,000 years ago. And that has been spoken countless times throughout the ages since that one night. And he comes down from his, God comes down from his throne to meet you tonight, to declare his love for you tonight, and to win your love. He says, here I am, take me. This is my body. Take, drink, this is my blood. It is all he has to offer, but it is infinitely more than anything you need. And he comes to us now. And what's so great about all this, and we're going to do this in just a second, is the rites we've had and the RCI students we've been praying for. It's almost like an engagement party for them as they go to confirmation and they get to partake for the first time in this glorious feast. And they're waiting and they're excited, and there's going to be so much joy on Easter Vigil on that Saturday night in just a week and a half. And we have one more piece that we're going to do before then, and it's called the presentation of the Lord's Prayer. That they have this opportunity to hear God's word, this beautiful gift. Is the Lord's Prayer not a gift that the groom gives to the bride with joy and love? And we now, as the people of God, will be handing on to these, the students of God, to learn, to receive, and to find great joy and delight in themselves. So I want to invite all the confirmation students up to the foot of the stairs as we have been doing, and their sponsors also. So come behind them. And a time for all of us, come forward, and a time for all of us to, again, keep them in our prayers.